Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. The program that I prepared this week is going to cover a variety of topics that may seem unrelated at first glance, but are closely related when understood in perspective. The first has to do with what I consider an exaggerated incident that was blown out of proportion by the news media. It has to do with the refusal of an Israeli-born American actress who refused to come to Israel to accept a large financial prize because she'd be required to sit on the same platform as the Prime Minister of Israel. There was a big reaction to what she did, but most, if not all, of the negative reaction didn't touch upon the fundamental problem, which is that she insulted not the Prime Minister, but rather she insulted the Jewish people and the Jewish state that came into existence there after almost 2,000 years of bitter exile. The second subject that I touch upon is the fact that April 25th is Anzac Day, which commemorates the Australian and New Zealand soldiers who fought in the First World War and whose victory in the Battle of Beersheba on October 31st, 1917, was a key element in the issuing of the Balfour Declaration, in which the British government committed itself to assist in the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. The battle has faded into history, and I think I can safely say that even leaders of the Zionist movement there are unaware of its importance in Jewish history. And finally, I will say a few words about the accomplishments of the State of Israel in its first 70 years, which really is its infancy. This includes the very existence of independent Jewish statehood, the fact that the entire land is in Jewish hands, although it started with only a sliver along the coast and expanded only fortuitously because of those who wanted to destroy it, and the fact that Israel has diplomatic relations with nations all over the world, and the fact that Israel is one of the greatest sources of energy for the support and development of Jewish identity everywhere in the world. And that is really something important. I shall be back after the break. Thanks again for listening.
There was a time you didn't worry about terrorism. It was something that happened in a faraway place or to someone else. But now you want to know. Now you want to understand. Now you're afraid that you might be in the danger zone. You need to listen to Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone every week, where you will find out the truth about what is going on in the world around you. Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone, right here on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
I want to start the program today with an item that should really be considered trivia, but it raised a tremendous response this week here in Israel, including from members of the Knesset and from government ministers. So I feel I must say a few words because perhaps the lesson that can be learned from the incident. Natalie Portman is an actress with many accomplishments. She was born Natalie Hirschlag in Jerusalem, was taken as a child to the United States. So she holds both U.S. and Israeli citizenship. The agitation began when it was announced she'd be receiving a $2 million award from the Genesis Foundation. The Genesis Foundation is sometimes known as the Jewish Nobel Prize. The prize was founded in 2012 and is given annually to those who inspire others through their dedication to the Jewish community and to Jewish values. That's what their statement is. By the way, I'm not sure what Jewish values are. From what I gather, Jewish values are defined by those who use the term, particularly in the United States, as whatever corresponds to the platform of the Democratic Party. There seem to be a lot of people who believe that if Moses returned to the earth, he would vote Democratic. By the way, the prize is given annually who'd inspire others, and past recipients include the former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, actor Michael Douglas, and musician Isaac Perlman. Now, this whole thing started, Natalie Portman was awarded this award, and she told the Genesis Prize Foundation that she was experiencing extreme distress, that was her term, over attending its ceremony and would not feel comfortable participating in any public events in Israel. So needless to say, political figures in Israel piled on that. Because of the criticism, Portman issued a new personal statement saying, "I choose not to attend because I do not want to appear as endorsing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who will be giving a speech at the ceremony." The actress says that she treasures her Israeli friends, but, and this is her words, "the mistreatment of those suffering from today's atrocities is simply not in line with my Jewish values." So here you have the expression Jewish values again, which seems to correspond to whatever somebody is thinking politically at that moment when they use the term. She doesn't define what she means by atrocities. I don't know what atrocities she's speaking about. She said, "I must stand up against violence, corruption, inequality, and the abuse of power." It seems to me she's describing the Palestinian Authority more than the State of Israel. At any rate, after receiving notice from Portman, the Genesis Prize Foundation canceled the ceremony, which is supposed to take place in June, but didn't say what will become of the $2 million in cash that goes along with the prize. While Portman made clear she'll not attend the ceremony, she has not declined the prize. That's nice. But she indicated, and this is to her credit, she indicated that a prize money would be divided among several of her favorite Israeli charities. Now, as I said, there was a big hullabaloo here in Israel, and Culture Minister Miri Regev lambasted the actresses announcement, calling her ripe fruit in the hands of the BDS supporters. And Energy Minister Yuval Steinitz, who is really a very calm guy, charged that her actions border on anti-Semitism, which I really think is an exaggeration. The problem is that her comments would be used by the BDS against Israel. A friend of mine who is a political activist, a fellow named Yisrael Meidad, said that Portman made mistakes, explaining she called Bibi a racist several years ago, and so she revealed her political leanings. She should not have used the word atrocities to describe Israeli government action. There are no atrocities here. It's a horrible term, and it's a BDS-style terminology. By the way, according to Meidad, I don't follow Portman's career, but apparently, according to Meidad, she also claimed that Israel was created after the Holocaust as a safe haven for the Jewish survivors and refugees. Now, obviously, Israel is much more than that. So I think what she said was really not too smart. Now, what is to be learned from this? That's the point here. What's to be learned is you have to be careful what you say. With the Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, says that wise men should be careful in their use of words, because she played into the hands of the BDS movement, which is, of course, opposed to the State of Israel. Now, the reason that she refused to come, she didn't want to sit on the same platform with Benjamin Netanyahu. So there is a fundamental issue that should be mentioned here, and that's the point I wanted to make. In the military, one is required to salute an officer whether one likes or dislikes or even knows that officer. A salute, what does a salute do? It recognizes and honors the rank. It honors what's on the shoulders of the individual, not the individual themselves. Because Benjamin Netanyahu is the prime minister of the state of Israel, which came into existence after almost 2,000 years of a difficult and painful exile culminating in the Holocaust, the prime minister is the symbol of restored Jewish sovereignty. And I don't use the word Jewish values, so I don't know what they are. Our prime minister, whether we like him or not, or agree with his politics or not, is the symbol of restored Jewish sovereignty after 2,000 years of exile. You can liken him to the rank on the shoulders of an officer in the military. Whether one agrees with his policies or not, to show him disrespect is an insult to the state and the people that he represents. So that is, I believe, is the major problem here. She doesn't want to sit on the same platform with our prime minister, means that she doesn't want to share a platform with the man who represents Israeli sovereignty and Jewish sovereignty after 2,000 years of exile. By the way, sovereignty is a word that's easily defined, much more easily defined than Jewish values. At any rate, from an entirely different perspective, Jewish law, halacha, mandates a blessing to be said when seeing a head of state, whether you like him or whether you don't like him or whether he's Jewish or not. There is a blessing. Blessed art thou who has given of his glory to humans. This is what you say when you see the head of state. I have had occasion to say it myself many years ago when I was a kid and I saw Harry Truman. Harry Truman is not Jewish. What the very fact that Jewish law mandates a blessing when seeing a head of state indicates it's indicative of the respect that must be shown to those who have risen to a position of national authority. And the prime minister of Israel is a very special person, no matter who holds the office, because he is the head of a Jewish state, which, as I said, as we all know, came into existence after almost 2,000 years of exile and after a Holocaust, and which exists as the safe haven for Jews, other than its religious value, unless, of course, you take into account that being able to save Jews from persecution, no matter where they are, is a form of Jewish value. That's a Jewish value I can accept. Back in January, I think it was 1992, I don't remember when it was, on a Shabbat, on a Sabbath, the state of Israel brought in thousands upon thousands of Ethiopian Jews into the state of Israel to save them from the persecution they were undergoing in Ethiopia. The rabbinate at that time says it's okay to violate the Sabbath to save Jewish lives. So that is a prime Jewish value, that saving Jewish lives in the state of Israel exists, among other things, as a place, as refuge to save Jewish lives. Of course, it has value much more than that, but that's not the subject of the discussion today. So, to insult the man who represents the state of Israel is to insult the Jewish people. It's to insult the Jewish history, as a matter of fact, as I see it. And therefore, this Natalie Portman Portman, as talented as an actress she may be, and I quite honestly don't remember seeing any of her films. The fact remains you have to be very careful. Again, as I said, the ethics of the fathers says you should be very careful what you say, because you don't know what others may derive from your statements. At any rate, I spent more time on this subject than I intended to, and I'll be back after the break.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I'm Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country from Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro, and in this segment of the program, I'm going to make a change in gears and provide the listeners with a history lesson. This may seem a little unusual, but I will explain. This week, April 25th, was Anzac Day. Anzac stands for Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. So why is this important for Israel? The answer is that the Anzacs were very crucial to the fact that the state of Israel exists today. This is a little known fact, but it is a fact. The Anzacs took part in two major battles in World War I. The first was a battle at Gallipoli, which was a terrible defeat. That's at the entrance to the capital city, Constantinople, or Istanbul. The second was the Battle of Beersheba, which was an astounding victory, which not only changed the course of world history, but in particular changed the course of Jewish history. Anzac Day, 25th of April, marks the anniversary of this first campaign that led to major casualties for Australian and New Zealand forces during the First World War. And Anzac Day remains one of the most important national occasions for both Australia and New Zealand, and it is commemorated even here in Israel at the cemeteries of the Allied soldiers. I attended it this year on the right near Hebrew University on Mount Scopus. The background is that in 1915, Australian New Zealand soldiers formed part of an Allied expedition that set out to capture the Gallipoli Peninsula to open the way for the Allied navies to the Black Sea. The objective was to capture Constantinople, the capital of the Ottoman Empire, which was an ally of Germany during the war. The Anzac force landed at Gallipoli on the 25th of April, 1915, had met fierce resistance from the Ottoman army, which was commanded by Mustafa Kemal, who was later known as Ataturk and was the first leader of modern Turkey. What had been planned as a bold strike to knock the Ottomans out of the war became a stalemate, and the campaign dragged on for 8 months. At the end of 1915, the Allied forces were evacuated after both sides had suffered heavy casualties. The Allied death total was over 56,000, including 8,700 from Australia and 2,700 from New Zealand. News of the landing at Gallipoli made a profound impact on Australians and New Zealanders at home, and 25th of April quickly became the day in which they remembered the sacrifice who had died in the war. Though the Gallipoli campaign failed to achieve its military objectives of capturing Constantinople and knocking the Ottoman Empire out of the war, the actions of the Anzac troops during the campaign left a powerful legacy, became known as the Anzac Legend, as an important part of the national identity of both countries. And this pretty much shapes the way their citizens have viewed both their past and their understanding of the present. Now, the heroism of the soldiers in the failed Gallipoli campaign made their sacrifices iconic, and it's often credited with securing the psychological independence of New Zealand and Australia. Now, what happened was, because of the defeat at Gallipoli, the Allies now had no choice than to fight the Turkish Empire along the extended route, which is Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, Sinai, Palestine, and Syria. In order to do that and gain support, the British made a series of contradictory promises to the Arabs and to the Zionists. And the consequences of these incompatible promises are still being played out today. In the words of Yaakov Herzog, an Israeli diplomat and the son of one of the former chief rabbis, had the Gallipoli campaign succeeded and had Turkey then made a separate peace, Palestine would have become an autonomous Arab province of the Turkish Empire or of an internationalized area if the empire were dissolved. In either case, in either event, the Zionist hope would have been quenched. There is no two ways about that. That as the importance of the Beersheba campaign. The Allies attacked Beersheba on the 31st of October 1917. They fought all day and could not penetrate the German and Turk defense until just as the sun was setting. The Anzac made a cavalry charge, probably the last in history, and overcame the defenses and captured Beersheba. The attack was not planned, but was done in desperation because the only water resources were in Beersheba itself, and had it not been captured, the horses upon which the Allied army depended, remember this is back in World War I, the horses would have died by the thousands. As a result of the victory, 2 days later, the Balfour Declaration was issued by which the British government committed itself to the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. The British eventually betrayed their promise, but that, of course, is another story. The head of the Allied armies was General Allenby, and his gamble to attack Beersheba despite the horrendous logistics problems, particularly water for the horses, it almost failed. Had it failed, there would not be a second chance. The front line at the southern end of Palestine would at best have deteriorated into a carbon copy of the Western Front in the First World War, which is just a butchery, no advance or a repetition of Gallipoli, which is a British pullout and defeat. We can never know. As events unfolded, even after capturing Jerusalem, Allenby's campaign to push the Turks out of Palestine and Syria was stalled for 9 months, because he has sent tens of thousands of troops back to Europe to meet the demands for manpower there. Had Beersheba not fallen, one of the possible results would have been an armistice, with Turkey retaining control of Palestine. The victory at Beersheba opened the way for the Allied capture of Palestine and Syria. Results of this victory, including the subsequent British and French struggle for domination and the administration of Palestine under a mandate for the British from the League of Nations, are still with us today. I believe that the unplanned, spontaneous charge of the 4th Brigade Australian Light Horse in the waning light of October 31st, 1917, was the hinge upon which the future of the Middle East and Zionist hopes turned. There's no doubt that the history of the world and today's geopolitical situation would be very different had the Allies failed to capture Beersheba, which at that time was a drab and muddy village, the very extreme edge of the Ottoman Empire, back on the 31st of October. As I said, the Balfour Declaration was issued 2 days later. I attended the Anzac Day Memorial on Mount Scopus this week, and after the general memorial, which only takes about a half hour, there's a special memorial for the Jewish soldiers who died and are buried there, and it's led by a rabbi, and they say Kel Moli Rachmin, a prayer for the dead, and also Kaddish. So the rabbi who spoke there made a speech, and I asked him to give me a copy because I was so touched by it. The speech has to do with the value of time. And the speech says the following. On his deathbed, Alexander the Great summoned his generals and told them he had three last wishes: that the best doctors should carry his coffin, and the wealth he had accumulated, gold, money, and other things, should be scattered along the procession to the cemetery, and his sand should hang loose outside the coffin for all to see. One of his generals, surprised by these unusual requests, asked Alexander to explain, and Alexander said, "I want the best doctors to carry my coffin to demonstrate in the face of death even the best doctors in the world have no power to heal. I want the road to be covered with my treasures so everybody sees it. Material wealth acquired on earth will stay on earth. We take to our grave no material wealth. Time is our most precious treasure because time is limited. We can produce wealth, but we cannot produce time. I want my hands to swing in the wind so people understand we come to this world empty-handed and we leave empty-handed after the most precious treasure of all is exhausted, and that treasure is time. When we give someone our time, we actually give a portion of our life that we can never take back. The brave soldiers buried in this cemetery made the ultimate sacrifice for our security. Their time came to an end. However, I believe there's a way that we may honor their memory day by day by giving our family and friends the best gift that we have, the gift of time." I was so moved by this speech Wednesday morning. And I asked the rabbi to send me a copy, which he did. He also quoted Psalm 90, which is attributed to Moshe Rabbeinu, which says, "Limnot yameinu kein hodah, navi levav chochma." Teach us to number our days so we may acquire a heart of wisdom. Having time is one thing. Knowing what to do it wisely is another, because none of us knows how much time is allotted to us. It behooves us to expend it in meaningful ways, especially with those whom we love and cherish. Start with our homes and foster within it shalom bayit, a tranquil and peaceful home. Let us resolve, therefore, to give some of our time daily to those whom we love and cherish, and may Hashem grant us the merit of our fallen soldiers, plenty of time to share with all." This is Rabbi Edward Belfer, who is associated with the Australian and New Zealand soldiers. And as I said, I attend every year for the last almost 20 years, and it's a very moving, and I think it's important, particularly for the listeners and others, to know the relationship between the Australian New Zealand troops and the fact that the State of Israel came into existence. The Battle of Beersheba was the most important battles, I believe, in the history of the world, and particularly for the Jewish people. I shall be back after the break.
Hello, I am Walter Bingham. If you want to hear the news behind the news and the true perspective on world affairs, then the Walter Bingham File is the program for you. We bring you interviews with the movers and shakers, political commentaries, and on-the-spot reports of events as they happen. All here every Tuesday, 4 p.m. Israel time, 9 a.m. Eastern time. And it's all archived on our website. Make it a date.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
There are essentially two holiday periods in Israel, and they are roughly 6 months apart. One is the traditional high holiday season, which starts in the month of Elul, the last month in the Hebrew calendar. Then it extends through Rosh Hashanah, the New Year, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and then through Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. The other holiday season starts on a sad day, the Holocaust Memorial Day. Then a week later, Memorial Day, for those lost in the battle to establish and maintain the Jewish state. This is followed by Independence Day. Yom HaAtzmaut. Unfortunately, for many Israelis, this is the end of the holiday season. But for many, the period continues until Jerusalem Day, which celebrates the return of Jerusalem in the Six-Day War to Jewish hands for the first time in almost 2,000 years. This year it falls on the 13th of May. I'm not happy that so many Israelis don't celebrate today, but that is a problem unto itself. Here in Jerusalem, where I live, it's a wonderful holiday. So while we are still in the midst of the holiday season, I want to make a review of our situation. I think a logical review, leads to the conclusion that Israel at 70 is doing quite well. Despite military threats and other challenges, the state of Israel is doing fine. Across the Arab lands, countries are crumbling, borders are being erased, and societies are being torn apart. In contrast, the nation-state of Israel is resolute, its borders are safe, and its society is robust. In terms of security, in the face of Iranian ambitions, Russian adventurism, and American retrenchment, Israel stands firm with the strongest military assembled in the Middle East, and we seem to have steady, experienced hands running the government. We have vigilance, patience, and diplomatic nimbleness, and these are seeing Israel well through the regional storms. Israel knows how to defend its borders and hasn't made any serious withdrawal mistakes lately. Can you imagine the suffering Israelis would be experienced had we withdrawn from the Golan Heights or the Samarian Heights? Palestinian leaders can yell all they want at the UN, but everybody knows that the Palestinians and Israelis, and perhaps also the Jordanians and others, are better off with their current situation where Israel firmly controls that area known as the West Bank, Judea and Samaria. As far as diplomacy, North American public opinion remains very pro-Israel, and the United States and Canada, can be expected to stand by Israel's side when it faces moments of challenge. Moreover, Israel's diplomatic horizons are expanding to include very important allies beyond North America and beyond Europe. We have trade and security delegations from China, India, Russia, Africa, and South America, and they're coming to Israel to seek opportunities to cooperate with Israel, not to isolate Israel. And apparently, behind the scenes, Israel's relations with Egypt, Saudi Arabia, other Sunni states had never been better. Keep in mind, they are threatened by the Shiite state, Iran. Key global players have come to accept Israel's strategic platform that the main conflict in the region is not Israel versus the Palestinians or Israel versus the Arabs. Instead, the main axis of defense and diplomatic activity in the Middle East is an alliance, pretty much unofficial, between Israel and many of the Arabs, together with the Western powers, against the Iranians and the jihadis. The forces of stability and moderation, with Israel in a lead role, are arrayed against the forces of violent and radical Islamic revolution. There seems to be some sort of an Israel strategy that has been largely successful. It involves patience and looking over the horizon. It involves being both flexible and firm. I think Israel can be called a regional area of stability, or perhaps even sanity. Now, despite all these BDS efforts, Israel's science and technology are in high demand everywhere. Israel's foreign currency reserves are very deep, $115 billion, and its exports are up to $102 billion. So the debt is manageable, unemployment is low, the banks are solvent, and the public seems to have confidence. The country now has natural gas and desalinated water, which should make Israel self-sufficient as well as a strategic player in the regional resources market. All this is good, and beyond that, Israel has Aliyah, about 30,000 people coming a year, which, by the way, is even more interesting when you contrast this with the situation elsewhere in our neighborhood. 3 million refugees are on the roads in the Middle East, and they're fleeing Africa and Arabia, and God knows how many are going to follow. And one of the greatest sources of energy in Israel is the intensification of the faith as an anchor in the country's societal makeup. We have a very high birth rate. We have more than is required to keep the population at the same level. And in, among the Western countries, I think the only two countries that have that kind of reproduction rate are Israel and, for some crazy reason, New Zealand. I don't know why. Israel is increasingly a nation of believers. And this is a source of health and strength. More and more people are getting interested in religion. So the overall, in the overall perspective, Israel is stronger than any of its enemies. And indeed, it might even be considered stronger than all of its enemies combined. But that is no reason for hubris. Perhaps most important of all, Israelis are not depressed by the challenges. According to surveys, Israel is the 11th happiest country in the world, which is pretty good. I have friends who say maybe they're not getting the message, but that's only as a joke. One of the Israel's most respected strategic thinkers is Professor Ephraim Inbar, who's the president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies. He wrote a 4,000-word essay published about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and he says, time is on Israel's side. A review of the balance of power between Israel and its foes, of the domestic features molding Israel's national power, and of Israel's standing in the international community validates the assessment that Israel has a dominant hand for the foreseeable future. But we should not become over-ambitious or overconfident. So on Israel's 70th Independence Day in this period now, it's important to emphasize to this perspective. We are doing quite well, even with the lingering conflict with the Palestinians, which is unfortunate, but is bearable. And Israel, apparently, with God's help, will continue to prosper and be and grow. And, of course, Israel's hand remains outstretched for peace anytime our adversaries are ready to meet that hand. So we're doing pretty well. I will quote the late great Israeli ambassador to Canada, Yaakov Herzog, the son of the former chief rabbi. Speaking in 1971 about the permanence of Israel, he said the following, and I quote, "We face perils. No man can guarantee that fighting will not resume tomorrow and that our soldiers will not have to fight against, again, bloody battles. But we know we have the strength to withstand them. With firmness touched with generosity, with strength uplifted by spiritual understanding, we can and we will move ahead. With all the difficulties and all the pressures, we are the generation of redemption. Let us indeed be worthy of this privilege that defies human logic and supersedes human vistas," unquote. He said that back in 1971. Life in Israel is full of meaning, and there's a lot of sacrifice, but there's also a lot of commitment. There's a lot of achievement, and I said, there's a lot of happiness. These are the crucial ingredients that make life satisfying and exciting. So we are standing, I believe, on the threshold of even greater things as long as we have faith in ourselves and in our God. I think that, you know, faith in our God has kept us going for 2,000 years of a very bitter exile. We can't return to our homeland after that and give up our faith. On the contrary, the very fact that we have returned to our homeland should reinforce our faith. And not only our faith in God, but I think God's faith in us. He expects us to act properly. So having said all that, till next week, take care of yourselves. I didn't want to sound like I was preaching, but at this time of the year, I get moved to think and speak this way. You'll have to forgive me. Until next time, Jay Shapiro signing off.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.